entry and the nighttime search. As to the alleged no-knock entry, the officers had reasonable suspicion of something more than a mere firearm. That something more was that a resident had used the firearm recently to commit a murder and that the firearm was an assault rifle. Either of these two reasons alone was sufficient under this court's precedent. As to the nighttime search, the plaintiff's challenge...
Is the assault rifle an undisputed fact or something that would have to be resolved by trial?
It is an undisputed fact, Your Honor. As we indicated in our brief, the defendants asserted this fact in its statement of material facts, not in genuine dispute, asserted it repeatedly, and the plaintiffs did not dispute that fact. Therefore, it is conceded for present purposes. As I said, either that reason or the other reason alone is sufficient under this court's precedent. In Geraldo, for example, this court found that a no-knock entry was justified because an occupant had a revolver to protect against robbers. Again, here we had a resident who had the firearm and he used it to commit a murder recently. Also in Crippen, this court found that the presence of a high-powered weapon was sufficient to justify a no-knock entry. And again, here we have a high-powered assault rifle. So either under
the request, the affidavit seek a holster, search for holsters, if you knew it was a high-powered assault weapon?
As far as I'm aware, you can have a holster for a rifle as well as other type of firearm, and there may have been other firearms.
You're suggesting to me that the request for the warrant said that this was is asserting what you're now asserting, this was a high-powered, dangerous weapon, we need a night search, there are exigent circumstances, this person has a history of violence, that was all in there?
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
None of it was in there?
The particular type of firearm was not in the application.
Okay. Anything else to suggest exigent circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor, that...
The mere fact that there was a commission of a crime doesn't do it.
I agree with that. Okay. The crime here was a murder.
Doesn't do it.
That in of itself does not do it.
Right.
The shooter, was Mr. Youngbae. The residence that the police were searching was Mr. Youngbae's residence. The judge...
Was it his residence? They assumed it was his residence.
They had sufficient evidence that the judge issuing the warrant was convinced that it was his residence. That evidence, as indicated in the warrant application, was that the detective had contacted the probation agency who was overseeing Mr. Youngbae, who was on supervised release following his conviction. The official there verified that that was Mr. Youngbae's address. The detective also double-checked with a law enforcement database. Once again, that confirmed that this was Mr. Youngbae's address. The detective also knew that Mr. Youngbae had been frequently seen in that neighborhood where the address is located, and as indicated in the application.
I'm still waiting for something on exigent circumstances.
Because under Geraldo, that is sufficient to establish exigent circumstances.
That there was a crime committed and a suspect was identified?
No, that there was an occupant or a resident of the place to be searched, that there were firearms at that residence, and that it was reasonably likely that that person might use the firearm given his violent propensity, in this case, having killed somebody.
Is there anything in the affidavit about his violent propensity?
The violent propensity, as in Geraldo, follows from the fact that he has this firearm and that he has a propensity to violence, namely he just murdered somebody. He was the shooter.
That is not what that case says. That is absolutely not what that case says. That case says that person was known to have a propensity for violence. You just made up something.
Well, respectfully, no, Your Honor. In Geraldo, the propensity...
You're saying that because there was a suspect who was accused of murder, that equals a propensity for violence. In fact, on these facts, quite the contrary, it looks like someone just got ticked off with someone else and did a really stupid thing, allegedly murdered somebody. There's nothing to indicate that this person had a propensity for violence. a propensity for violence?
I believe a murderer has a propensity to violence.
Really? People are convicted of what we call either manslaughter, first or second degree murder, who don't necessarily have a propensity for it. There may be circumstances that occur and you kill someone and you may go to jail for it, but it doesn't mean that you have a history of murder or a history of violence.
Well, the murder itself is the history of violence in this particular case.
You think that's what that prior case says?
This case is much stronger than the prior case. The prior case, the occupant simply had a revolver to protect himself against robbers. There was no evidence that he had actually used it. In this case, we have evidence that Mr. Youngbae actually used it to commit a murder, and under the circumstances of that murder, it was a quite brazen murder. I mean, Mr. Youngbae deliberately tracked the victim down, located him, murdered him over apparently nothing more than a perceived slight. I think under those circumstances, the officers really did have a legitimate concern about their safety when they were going to be searching his residence for the murder weapon that he had used. And I respectfully submit that under Geraldo, the facts in Geraldo were much less weighty than the facts in this case, where we have proof.
You must be reading a different case.
Then we'll have to disagree about Geraldo, Your Honor. There's also Crippen as well, which we do rely upon, and that the presence there of the assault rifle is equivalent to the high-powered weapon in Crippen.
Geraldo says that the officers, from the opinion, had specific knowledge that this resident kept the firearm to protect against intruders and therefore might be quick to use it. There was no such evidence here.
You assumed
that he was a resident. You certainly didn't know that he had a revolver in this place. In fact, did you request searches of other places as well?
Yes. The others involved in the
murder. You
really
weren't sure where he was?
No, this was his residence.
It wasn't his residence. This was what you assumed was his residence. I'm not quibbling with you there, but go ahead.
Okay, I do disagree. It was his residence. Certainly the evidence, the information known to the police established it.
That's a different point. The information known to the police, and could they reasonably act on that, you're probably fine there. But it was not his residence, as it turned out.
I do disagree with that, Your Honor. The facts do establish that it was his residence, that he would frequently come and go from the residence, that he had a room at the residence, that he kept clothing at the residence, that he may have been at the residence even during the week in which the police searched. I mean, that is the evidence from the plaintiffs themselves. So I would...
The question I'm asking you is there was a request for search of other places, search for the weapon, right?
Also for firearms, correct.
In connection with this murder?
Correct, Your Honor.
Suggesting that is quite different from Geraldo, where you knew, had very good specific evidence that the weapon was there and a person who used that weapon was there. You weren't sure where the weapon was.
Regardless of the validity of the other searches, that's not at issue in this case. This search of this residence, we knew that Mr. Youngbae was the shooter. That was the information that the police had, that Mr. Youngbae was the shooter. So certainly as to his residence, they were justified. The judge found probable cause that firearms would be found there. The officers are entitled to rely upon that judge's determination, unless it's just completely...
No, but that isn't the question.
For purposes of qualified immunity.
The question is whether or not you had an exception to the knock rule. Not whether or not you could have gotten a warrant to search this place in daytime. You could have gotten a warrant to search it in daytime. I'm not quibbling there. I'm asking whether you had something that allowed the police officers to do what they did, which was beyond searching at daytime and allegedly not in compliance with the knock rule. That's in dispute, obviously, but... Mm-hmm.
As far as the nighttime search, we believe that those same circumstances justifying a no-knock entry also justified the nighttime search. Furthermore, there was even more probable cause to believe, in our view, that the weapon would be found by searching at night because Mr. Youngbae would be more likely at his residence at night, and therefore they would be more likely to find the firearm.
All of this was in the submission to the judge who issued the warrant?
No, the latter fact is a reasonable inference, which this court held in Thomas. It's reason enough to believe that a suspect is at home when you search the home at night.
And that's reason enough to avoid the D.C. requirement that you search during day unless there is a specific exception or authorization granted?
Well, whether it violates a district statute is irrelevant for Fourth Amendment analysis, as the Supreme Court held in Virginia versus Moore. State law privacy protections are not incorporated into the Fourth Amendment. And there's another fundamental problem with that argument, is that the Fourth Amendment doesn't require that a warrant specify the time for its execution. No-knock entries are one example, even though it's a constitutional requirement. A warrant does not need specifically authorize a no-knock entry, and the Supreme Court in Dahlia provided a rationale which explains that the warrant clause of the Fourth Amendment only requires three things. None of those involve the manner in which police execute a warrant. The manner in which they do so is within the discretion of the police, and it's subject to later judicial review as to its reasonableness. But we've satisfied, we believe, under these facts, for the reasons I've stated, that it was both reasonable to conduct a no-knock entry and it was reasonable to search at night.
Can I ask you about the warrant itself? There seems to be a debate about what the meaning of the in the daytime slash at any time of day or night is. Mm-hmm. And I take it the government's position is that it's both, that the slash means or?
Correct.
Have you ever seen, and do you have any idea what the practice of magistrates generally is with respect to these? It seems on its face like the more likely thing here is you scratch out one or the other side of this slash. Do you have any idea what the actual practice is? Have you seen warrants before where one or the other side are slashed off?
I mean, personally, I usually don't deal with warrants. I think there may have been some evidence in the record that this was not unique, that other warrants...
Well, how about the other side of the question, whether... It may not be unique, but is the typical thing to put a line through one or the other side?
I don't know. I don't think the record would. I don't think the record would show either way. Regardless, it's what a reasonable officer reading this warrant would believe, and certainly, in our view, the warrant is plain that it authorizes a nighttime search. The judge obviously chose not to modify the language.
Chose or forgot.
Right. Well, we have to presume, I think, under the law, that the judge chose, that the judge didn't just make a mistake, that the judge forgot. We shouldn't presume, even for laypersons, that laypersons, when they sign legal documents, are presumed to understand and know what they are signing. That's consistent with the law, and so consistent with that legal presumption. The only reasonable conclusion is that the judge chose to leave this language
That's
in there.
Such a wild stretch. There's no law that says that.
Well,
we assume in the warrant context that the judge meant to indicate one thing by failure to scratch or not. We don't know what that meant. We have no idea what that meant.
Right. Therefore, the plain language says in the night, which authorizes a nighttime search. I mean, it's the plaintiff who are trying to undermine the language of the warrant.
Isn't there more to the context? Isn't a reasonable officer supposed to understand, forgetting whether or not we incorporate state law, isn't a reasonable officer supposed to understand the requirements of D.C. law and understand that unless you have an authorization for a night search, you don't have it? A reasonable officer in D.C.? Isn't that what a reasonable officer would understand?
For purposes of district law, that's correct, and I think
For purposes of reasonableness.
For purposes of fourth...
I'm reading this document. I'm an officer in D.C. On its face, to the three of us who are not officers, it's not clear what this means to say. You're absolutely right. It isn't clear. But isn't it clear to a reasonable officer, supposedly knowing D.C. law, if I don't have an authorization for a night search, I better get one if I want it. And if I don't have it, I don't have it.
For purposes of district law, that is correct. I believe a reasonable officer could read this warrant, and since it says in the night, could believe that it authorized execution at night. I see I'm out of time. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal if there's no further questions.
We'll hear from the appellee.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, James Cox from Jenner and Block for Ms. Youngbae and Mr. Butler. Your Honor, this case involves a violent 4 a.m. search that had a devastating impact on the lives of the residents of 1312 Queen Street Northeast. Regardless of the outcome of this appeal, there will be a trial addressing, among other things, the reasonableness of that search. Defendants are seeking a ruling that there was no constitutional problem with some aspects of the search prior to that trial, and the district court was correct that they're not entitled to such a ruling. I want to start by addressing a topic that you were just discussing with Mr. Shifferly regarding the contents of the warrant. District of Columbia law requires that for a warrant to authorize a no-knock search, that authorization be express. That requirement is stated in DC Code 23-523B. It's clear that this warrant, which does not cross out either of the two options, is not an express authorization of a nighttime search.
Can I ask you about the statute? I have to say, not only is the warrant confusing, but so is the statute. So if we could focus on 23-521F5. You want to take a look at it. It says, a search warrant shall contain a direction that the warrant be executed during the hours of daylight, or where the judicial officers have found cause, and authorization for execution at any time of day or night. So that word and, which is not the word you would be expecting there, says and, sounds like an exact description of the government's position. That is, if you want to execute at night, you get a warrant that says it may be executed during the hours of daylight and at any time of day or night. I know that sounds ridiculous, but that is what the statute says.
Your Honor, I think linguistically that isn't the best interpretation of the warrant form, and to respond to a question...
No, I'm not asking about the warrant form. I'm asking about the statute just for the moment. It sounds like if you want to search at night, you have to have a direction that the warrant be executed during the hours of daylight and at any time of day or night. And that's what this warrant says.
Your Honor, I think the statute has been read consistent with the ordinary linguistic understanding that you were dealing with two options. One option is anytime, day or night. One option is during daylight hours, and those two options are mutually exclusive. I agree with you that the statute is not a model of clarity.
Do we have any idea what the normal practice is?
Your Honor, I think in most cases one of the options is crossed out.
Is that in the record, or that's just what?
No, Your Honor, that's just my understanding of the standard practice.
Okay.
Specifically, I think the statutory provision in 23-521 that we were just discussing needs to be read together with 522 and 523 to understand the details of what it means, and especially I think it's important to look at 523B, which states that a search warrant may be executed any day of the week, and in the absence of express authorization in the warrant pursuant to 521F5, shall be executed only during the hours of daylight. So it requires that express authorization in the warrant, and I don't think this warrant form can be read as express authorization, or that any reasonable officer could have read it as express authorization.
So if we could skip ahead to what seems to me the hardest issue for you on this point, which is whether it is clearly established, not whether it's a violation, but whether it's clearly established that a violation of a state rule with respect to nighttime searches violates the Fourth Amendment. Not whether it does, but whether it's clearly established in light of Virginia versus Moore. And I just want to read you the sections of Virginia versus Moore which are giving me heartburn about this. Okay, Virginia versus Moore begins, "We consider whether a police officer violates the Fourth Amendment by making an arrest based on probable cause but prohibited by state law." And the court holds that it doesn't. The court says, "We are aware of no historical indication that those who ratified the Fourth Amendment understood it as a redundant guarantee of whatever limits on search and seizure legislators might have enacted." It then goes on to say, in Cooper versus California, we reversed a state court that had held the search of a seized vehicle to be in violation of the Fourth Amendment because state law did not explicitly authorize the search. We concluded that whether state law authorized the search was irrelevant. States, we said, remained free to impose higher standards on searches and seizures than required by the federal Constitution. And just indulge me one more, because this is going to give you a bunch of stuff to try to respond to. In California, and then again, I'm quoting from the opinion in Moore. In California versus Greenwood, we held that the search of an individual's garbage forbidden by California's Constitution was not forbidden by the Fourth Amendment. Whether or not a search is reasonable within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment, we said, has never depended on the law of the particular state. What state, individual states may surely construe their own constitutions as imposing more stringent constraints on police conduct than does the federal constitution, state law does not alter the content of the Fourth Amendment. Now, I'm asking you two questions here, of course. One is, even if they did violate state law, did they violate the Fourth Amendment? But more important, could a reasonable officer who has in his hands Virginia versus Moore and is reading it during the search, must he conclude that it's clearly established that this violates the federal constitution?
I think the answer is yes, Your Honor. And I think this case is different from Virginia versus Moore because of the nature of the constitutional problem here. The nature of the constitutional problem here is a problem related to the warrant requirement, and that's that no reasonable, neutral judge ever approved a nighttime search in this case. Now, state law is relevant to reading the warrant and figuring out whether the judge in this case, Judge Hess, approved a nighttime search in this warrant.
Does the Fourth Amendment extend to that question? It seems from Moore and from Dahlia that the only question for the neutral magistrate is, are there reasonable grounds to believe that evidence of a crime is on that scene? That's the only, and to describe in particularity what's to be searched, I can't remember what the third element of Dahlia is. But there is no constitutional case that's held that, except with respect to knock and announce, which we'll talk about next, that restrictions on the time, place, manner of the search have anything to do with the warrant requirement.
Your Honor, I want to turn back to Dahlia because I think I disagree with that. In Dahlia, the three elements that the court cited in Dahlia were a demonstration of probable cause, a particular description of the place to be searched and the thing to be seized, and issuance by a neutral magistrate. And I think I disagree with the conclusion that no constitutional case has ever held that satisfaction of the issuance by a requirement of issuance by a neutral magistrate doesn't depend on conditions that the magistrate set on his or her determination of reasonableness. If a magistrate says, in this case, only a search during the daytime is reasonable, then to say that a neutral magistrate has determined that a search at night is reasonable would distort the requirement of issuance by a neutral magistrate and the constitutional safeguard of that neutral review.
I take your point as going to the question of whether it's constitutional. I'm still having difficulty understanding how a reasonable officer could understand that to be clearly established.
Your Honor, I think generally the concept that the boundaries of what an officer may do in executing a warrant are set by the limitations imposed on the face of the warrant itself. I think that principle is clearly established by cases like Bivens and Horton versus California.
That's at a very high level of generality.
That's a very high level of generality.
And that's exactly what the court in Wilson versus Lane said was too high a level of generality in that case. So we have to get down to the more narrow question of whether they should have understood that even if there were a limitation, if there were a state limitation on the nighttime search, that it would violate the Constitution.
Following up on this, answering your question, please, hasn't the Supreme Court said an officer cannot be seen to act reasonably in following what we would know to be an unacceptable condition in a warrant.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
I mean, isn't that the answer to what Judge Garland is saying? The fact that a warrant allows something doesn't mean that a reasonable officer can follow it.
I think it's both correct that the fact that a warrant allows something doesn't mean that a reasonable officer could follow it. And I think it's also correct that the fact that a neutral judge in issuing a warrant limited the warrant, that fact constrains what a reasonable officer could believe was authorized by the warrant. And here I think no reasonable officer could have believed that this warrant authorized a nighttime search. Judge Garland, going back to your question, I think at a greater level of specificity specific to the question of a nighttime search, does a warrant that does not authorize a nighttime search, if the officers search at night anyway, is that a violation of the Fourth Amendment? I think the out-of-circuit precedent establishes a clear consensus that that is the case. I'll concede that there is no in-circuit precedent on that point, but I think this Court's decisions have established that such an out-of-circuit consensus is sufficient to make the law clearly established. In cases like the O'Rourke decision from the Tenth Circuit, the decision in U.S. ex rel. Boyance versus Myers from the Third Circuit, I think those cases clearly establish that where a warrant authorizes only a search in daytime, if you end up searching at night, as one of those decisions said, that's just as bad as if there had been no warrant authorizing the search, and indeed it might be worse.
Well, so you have two out-of-circuit cases.
I think there's at least a third, United States versus Merritt, that I'd also...
Both of those were before Moore. And after Moore, the Tenth Circuit said, applied Moore in Bowling versus Rector.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think the distinction here is that...
I'm only asking, again, I know you can distinguish these, and you're doing a good job of it. The question is whether a reasonable officer not trained at Jenner and Block can do that. and to the extent to which it is clearly established, that's what I'm trying to focus on.
Your Honor, I think Moore doesn't alter the point that the warrant itself sets the boundaries of what is reasonably authorized for a search. And as long as the warrant itself limits the search to daytime only, no reasonable officer, regardless of Moore, could have understood that search, that it would be reasonable to conduct a search at night.
Moore, the state says you can't arrest people for misdemeanors, and nonetheless it's constitutional to do it. What's the deal there?
Your Honor, the difference in this case is that the only reference to state law is in figuring out what this warrant means. The core requirement of authorization by a neutral and the core principle that what a warrant authorizes is limited to what's stated in that warrant, and limitations on that warrant are valid limitations. That principle isn't a principle of state law. It's a principle of federal constitutional law. And as a result, a reasonable officer would understand that principle not to have been affected in any way by Moore, unlike the kinds of situations you're describing in which the question is simply whether an arrest for a particular offense is constitutional, where the only problem is a state law problem, not a problem with something like the federal requirement of approval by a detached neutral magistrate. Very briefly, with respect to the knock and announce.
What about in California versus Green, it's a search without any warrant at all. No neutral magistrate, and the state law forbid it. And yet the court said it was all right.
Your Honor, in this case, there's no argument from D.C. that this search would have been constitutional without a warrant. So the existence of the warrant and the validity of the warrant is necessary here for the nighttime search to have been constitutional. I don't think D.C. can argue that the search was constitutional but for the warrant.
All right, I'll let you go on to knock and announce.
Okay. Very briefly, I think the critical point to make is that there are a number of critical disputes of fact with respect to the facts used by the District of Columbia as a basis to justify their claim of exigent circumstances, and those facts preclude summary judgment here.
Can I ask you, again, I want to skip directly to the bottom line, which is, well, maybe it's not the bottom line, since after Pearson, either question can be the bottom line, but the bottom line of whether it's clearly established. And again, this time I ask you to imagine the officer clutching in his hands United States versus Crippen and United States versus Geraldo. And reading in United States versus Geraldo, it says, in Geraldo, we explicitly reserve the question whether the mere presence of a gun could be sufficient to establish the exigent circumstances, which no longer required a no-knock rule. That is saying we've left undecided the question whether the mere presence of a gun was enough. And in this case, a magistrate has found probable cause to believe that there will be a gun there. The officers certainly have enough evidence for probable cause. That's not to establish certainty, but that can't be the requirement. So if a reasonable officer says, look, I'm reading this and it says the D.C. Circuit has said that we haven't even decided the question of whether a gun is enough, and here we have more than a gun, how can I believe that it's clearly established that this is an unconstitutional search?
Your Honor, I think the critical language in the passage you just quoted from Crippen is language could be. A gun could be enough. The bottom line is that in any particularized situation, considering all of the facts, the officers still have to have a reasonable belief of immediate danger to justify the particular exception to the constitutional knock-and-announce requirement that they're claiming. So here, Crippen and Geraldo are addressing whether in any situation it would be possible.
Well, that's not how, to be fair, that's not even how I read it, let alone how I think a reasonable officer should read it. I read this as leaving open the possibility that depending on the circumstances, but in any circumstance, that the mere presence of a gun might be sufficient. Now, I might rule myself that wouldn't be sufficient, but it does sound for an officer to be reading this to think that this is a category. Now, I appreciate that this may be wrong, but we also have the Geraldo in which the court relies on two facts. One is evidence of a violent tendency. And with due respect to Judge Edwards, I think that if an officer has reason to believe, as they have here, that somebody has murdered somebody with repeated gunshot wounds, not one, but repeatedly, which is what the evidence shows here, undisputed evidence. And second, the second point that is mentioned and relied on in Geraldo, which is the fact that they assembled a SWAT team and took the precaution of using a flashbang, tends to show that is how they viewed the situation, both of which are what happened here. Not that it's necessarily constitutional, but that an officer can't be faulted for thinking it's not clearly established.
Your Honor, I mean, I think the key, all of this sort of has to go back to the basic principle from Richards versus Wisconsin, that without a reasonable belief of immediate danger, there is no constitutional exception to the no-knock rule that could apply in this situation. And I think Geraldo and Crippen both applied that general principle to facts that are very distinguishable from here. Geraldo involving a case in which officers had specific information that an occupant of the house intended to use a revolver against potential intruders based on fear born out of prior robberies. Crippen, a rocket launcher.
I got the rocket launcher part. Yeah. I think you can easily distinguish that. I'm having some difficulty distinguishing, but again, thinking in my role as a police officer on the scene, not in my role as sitting here quietly several years later, to distinguish between knowing somebody is an enforcer of a drug gang and has a gun in his hand, but, you know, maybe he wouldn't risk, killing a police officer over that, versus somebody who has just recently demonstrated the depravity of having repeatedly shot somebody on a public street and murdered them and thinking you can get away with it. Now, I appreciate, again, that these are distinguishable on some fact basis, but the question is whether they are so distinguishable that a police officer, that we can say the police officer had to know that it was clearly established what he was doing was different than what was approved in these other cases.
Your Honor, I think they're so distinguishable because the rest of the facts of this case indicate certainly that none of the experienced officers here perceived an immediate danger, and also suggest objectively that no immediate danger from knocking and announcing.
They do have, just with respect to the SWAT team, they have 23 officers, 23, including two snipers and at least looked like half a dozen shields. I mean, this doesn't, on any objective basis, it looks like they were expecting trouble. I don't think you can, I mean, maybe they weren't, maybe they really weren't, but that's really not the issue. The question is whether it appears that they did, and I mean, it certainly appears that they did, and it's the same thing we relied on in our other case.
Were any of these alleged horribles submitted when the request for the warrant was made?
No, Your Honor. None of these, this parade of horribles was submitted in the warrant affidavit, was presented to the magistrate directly. And also, the overwhelming majority of them aren't listed in the officer's operational plan for the search.
Operational plan either. I mean, that's the perplexing thing. It seems to me that would a reasonable officer think that I can say after the fact I can conjure up a list of horribles and that'll be okay? I don't read the case law to say you can do that, but I don't recall any of these things, like someone being shot many times, a depraved individual.
Well, the multiple gunshots are included on the operational plan in the first sentence.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think what's more important is what's not included in the operational plan. Looking at page 50 of the joint appendix in the operational plan, there's no suspect information. The suspect information is left blank, and indeed, there's no physical description or notation of the characteristics of Mr. Youngbae anywhere in the record. That doesn't seem to be consistent with the sense that these officers actually believed there was a reasonable threat. They would be confronted by a dangerous Mr. Youngbae with a firearm. There's no arrest warrant issued for Mr. Youngbae at this point. With respect to the assault rifle, there's no mention of it in the affidavit or in the operational plan. And indeed, there's no.
I'm not relying on the assault rifle for exactly that point. Although I understood from opposing counsel that you did not challenged as a undisputed fact that he used one, or that there was one.
Your Honor, we don't challenge as an undisputed fact that an assault rifle was used in the underlying murder that was being investigated. Yeah. That later came out. I think there is a good amount of factual dispute about what the officers understood, how likely the officers thought it was that
None of that is really relevant, right? Again, with respect, I think that we're mixing two issues here, which is the what's needed to get a nighttime warrant, and that under the state law requires it being presented, and where we are now, which is on the knock and announce issue, which has nothing to do with the presentation to the magistrate. It has to do what reasonable officers would do, not what they actually knew, not what they subjectively worried about, but what they actually knew. And I don't think it's disputed, maybe you are disputed, that they had reasonable cause to believe. There is an arrest warrant for this guy, isn't there?
At the time of the search, no, Your Honor, there was no arrest.
Are you disputing that there was reasonable grounds to believe that he was the murderer? That they did not have reasonable grounds to believe that he was the murderer?
No, Your Honor, I'm not disputing the reasonable grounds to suspect him as one of the people involved in this murder.
All right. So the question of whether they really suspected him or not, or whether they wrote it down on a piece of paper or not, I'm not sure why that's relevant. The question is whether an objective officer, not particularly these officers, who reasonably suspected him to be involved in a murder involving repeated gunshots, and who on their face reacted in the way we described in another case, namely with flashbangs and a large SWAT team, whether under those circumstances a reasonable officer should believe it was clearly established that it was unconstitutional to go in without a knock and announce. I'm not putting this wrongly, am I? The law question. I appreciate you disagree with the result, but I'm not putting the law question wrong, am I?
No, Your Honor. I don't think you're putting the legal question incorrectly. I think the problem is, and the reason why it would be clearly established that the failure to comply with the constitutional knock-and-announce requirement was a violation of clearly established law, is because the facts viewed in the light most favorably to Mr. Youngbae suggest that the officers didn't have, that objectively the officers would not have had a reasonable belief of immediate danger. And I think the our brief at pages 51 through 54, I think, goes through a detailed recitation of those facts. And since I'm so far over time, I won't go through all of that detail again. But I think in preparation for the search and in actually conducting the search, the statements and actions of these officers do not suggest that the facts were such that a reasonable officer would have had a concern for his immediate safety that would have justified failing.
Just to be clear, again, to get the law straight, it's under circumstances presenting a threat of physical violence. Is it immediate threat to their personal safety? I don't see it. I'm reading from Richards. I didn't see those words.
Your Honor, I think the Supreme Court and this Court have used different words. I think the word immediate danger have been used in some of those cases. I think threat of violence has been used in others.
Okay. All right. Thank you for letting us off the hook for a moment and let us pass on to the next counsel. How much time does he have left? All right. Well, we'll give you, given that I wouldn't say we forced the other side to speak longer, we'll give you an extra 2 minutes.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I'll limit myself to the clearly established prong. I think it's, with regard to the no-knock entry, if this court has reserved the question specifically whether even the mere presence of a firearm is enough, that establishes that it is not clearly established. This court wouldn't reserve questions, the answer to which is clearly established. And certainly in light of Geraldo and Crippen, such right as the plaintiffs allege is not clearly established. As to the nighttime search, there would be several levels that the plaintiff would have to get past to show clearly established. As Judge Garland, you pointed out, the Virginia versus Moore hurdle is obviously a very high one. They would have to show that despite those statements in Virginia versus Moore, that nevertheless it would be clearly established to a reasonable officer that somehow the district's statute was incorporated into the Fourth Amendment. There's also the hurdle of Dahlia itself, which even if Virginia versus Moore didn't resolve the issue, they still can't get past Dahlia, which says that there are three requirements under the warrant clause. None of those requirements involve authorizing
the nighttime. That's something of dicta with respect to this case. That is, they didn't address this question about state law limitations on time, manner, and place or anything, right? It's just a general statement.
That's true. I'm arguing that something beyond state law, the state law issue, it's regardless of what state law may or may not require, does the Fourth Amendment
warrant clause. Put it another way, that case didn't actually involve a federal magistrate who said you can only go during the day.
That's correct. I'm relying upon the rationale of Dahlia, which I think a reasonable officer could rely upon that rationale. There's also the cases that we cited, Barron and Garcia, again, at another level at which they would have to show the law is clearly established, in which the same language in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, those courts held the same language in a warrant there authorized a nighttime search. And certainly if those judges could believe that this warrant language authorized a nighttime search, a reasonable officer could believe so as well as the cases within the district, such as LJW and Hines, where there was noncompliance with the district's statutory requirement regarding nighttime searches, and nevertheless the court held that technical noncompliance is not a violation of district law. It does not render the search invalid under district law. So for all those reasons, they cannot show a nighttime search is clearly established. I would say particularly when we're talking about an issue of dangerousness to the officers, I think where that's the issue, it would be incredibly unfair to those officers, where it's a danger to themselves to force them to make these clever, lawyerly distinctions in reading the cases.
Clever seems unfair, I think.
Well.
Lawyerly, I take as a good adjective, but clever seems in this situation to be a little unfair.
I'll limit myself to lawyerly distinctions, then, Your Honor. If there are
any questions?
No further questions?
We'll take the case under submission. Very well argued case. We appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.